And today we compensate in part for this oversight by presenting a woman who has distinguished herself in the demanding and competitive fields of law and government, and in doing so has demonstrated again that sex is no determinant of ability, dedication, and value to society. Our speaker is a native of Missouri and a graduate of the University of Missouri, and after graduation from the law school at the University of Michigan in 1940, she chose to make her home and launch her career in Michigan. After a period of legal work with agencies of government, she was elected to the Michigan House of Representatives in 1948 and served in that body for two terms. Then her interest turned to judicial service, and she was a judge and recorder in Detroit's Recorder's Court from 1953 until her election to the Congress in 1954 as the representative from Michigan's 17th District. And she has served there continuously since that time. Her earlier apprenticeship had prepared her well for the challenges and opportunities in Washington, for she was soon assigned to membership on the House Banking and Currency Committee and on the Government Operations Committee. Relative newcomers seldom qualify for such important responsibilities. And then she was appointed in 1961 as one of the 8 House members of the Joint Economic Committee, and she currently serves as chairman of the Subcommittee on Fiscal Policy. And further recognition of her outstanding ability in the area of finance was accorded to her in 1962, when she became a member of the powerful Ways and Means Committee of the House of Representatives. When our speaker was invited to participate in this ceremony, I explained to her that a year ago, after Congressman Ford from Grand Rapids was elected minority leader of the House of Representatives, he was invited to speak at the March commencement. And it was then decided that we should honor our distinguished alumnus, Congressman John Mackey from Flint, and balance the political picture at the same time. And you will recall that he was the speaker at the December commencement. Today's speaker was invited not as a Democrat or as a Republican, but as a distinguished woman, in the belief that her appearance might serve to encourage our graduates, the women especially, to assume their full responsibilities as citizens. Her acceptance was quick and gracious, as it has always been when she has been called upon to act in the interests of this university and the people of Michigan. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome again to Michigan State University and present to this graduating class, the faculty and our guests, a truly distinguished citizen of Michigan, the Honorable Martha W. Griffiths. Mrs. Griffiths.
Thank you very much, President Hanna, members of the Board of Trustees, faculty members of Michigan State University, members of the graduating class, your parents, and your friends. Thank you for the honor of permitting me to deliver this commencement address at the 1966 winter graduation of this great university. I feel that it was, in addition, a sort of Ann Landers touch to making home happy, because my husband feels that even the honorary alumni of this institution are entitled to root unabashedly for your football team, regardless of their own alma mater. So you have gathered unto yourself 2 ardent supporters. And I must say that I have always been an ardent supporter of President Hanna and of the scholastic standing of this university. As I prepared to make this speech, I was happy to look back at the beginnings of the university and to read the dedicatory speech of President Williams at that time. Quite frankly, if I thought I could have gotten away with it, I would have reread that speech It's one of the really great speeches, I am sure. I would like also to take this particular moment, particularly to congratulate the girls who came to this college and to this university. As a graduate myself of a land-grant college, I have observed that land-grant colleges have one great thing that is reserved for those colleges. In general, they have more young men than women. I would like also to say to the girls that now that you really are graduating, tomorrow you are not going to be simply resting. The statistics now in the Labor Department show that 81% of those of you who have college degrees will work almost all of your life outside of your home. In 1940, when Mr. Griffiths and I received our graduate degrees, as we began our search for jobs, we were concerned with one overriding fact that threatened all other plans. The same fact that confronts this graduating class today. That fact was then and is today, war. 6 years after we were graduated, and 21 years ago, August the 6th, World War II, for all practical purposes, ceased when the United States dropped the first atomic bomb. You are, therefore, the first generation to come to your graduation, having lived all of your life under the shadow of that bomb. It may seem incredible now, but the power of the bomb was only dimly understood for a long time. I remember a speech as late as 10 years ago on the floor of the House of Congress, where the bomb's power was explained to a horror-stricken and unknowing House. 10 years ago, the mere suggestion of a test ban was considered ridiculous. When at last the power of the bomb was widely understood, there were those who believed that this frightful weapon would end war. Those people were wrong. The bomb did not bring peace. It increased the distance possible between possible enemies. Every nation today, with the bomb and a delivery system, is the enemy, real or potential, of every other power on earth. The bomb did not stop war. The linguists of the world are at least as inventive as the scientists. War is now called peace. And aggression is called liberation. Battlegrounds on which the great powers meet are called civil wars, as in the so-called Greek Civil War, where five governments fell between June of 47 and June of 49. That battle ended when we successfully stopped supplies entering Greece from Russia. The relationship of the bomb to war is like Juliet to Romeo As she said, 'Tis but thy name that is my enemy. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? And Romeo, as he answered, call me but love, and I'll be new baptized. Henceforth, I never will be Romeo. So it is with war. We have changed the name. The purists among us, those who believe that a spade should be called a spade, as well as those who understand the American political system, still feel that at least where America is concerned, Congress should declare war. I have often wondered what these people think we would be doing if Russia or China had a 45-minute open debate on whether or not to go to war with us or one of our allies. Unless long usage can assure nations of the earth that nuclear warheads will not be used, a large nation with the bomb will never declare war again. In less than the time it would take to pass the declaration of war, the declaring nation would be cinders. One nation, or any nation, can renounce war. But unless all nations renounce war, no nation will survive who announces now that it will not defend itself. If the pledge of America to defend the defenseless prevails now and in the future, then indeed we will have arrived at the time when peace can be discussed in earnest. To the extent that the bomb helped destroy the old European colonial powers, it in fact helped create war. Since your birth, 52 new nations have been added to the world. The right of each country to select its own government is the right, among other rights, to create disorder, to set up a different standard of values, a different view of crime, and is the right, finally, to aid in pulling the rest of the world into poverty, chaos, and death. At a time when the world's demand for production of goods demands vast free trade areas, 52 new national boundaries have been set up, each with a tariff commission which would like to see their goods avidly purchased abroad and heavy import duties on all incoming goods. At the present moment, Western Europe, economically the most advanced of all areas outside the United States, cannot agree upon a common market. And the president of France, even this week, seeks to reinstitute the old bilateral agreements between nations in place of a common defense. He is indeed living in yesterday. In place of brute strength, the ideal way to peace, of course, is cooperation among all nations and reasoned decisions between all people. In such discussions, China would eventually have to be included. But your government has repeatedly tried to talk with China. Their only answer is that they will not talk unless we withdraw our recognition of Formosa. America did not by design seek the position of leadership and responsibility which she holds in the world today. as a nation. We have offered peace formulas from our own national experience, the League of Nations and the United Nations are really built on the theory of our national government. As the European Common Market, Latin American and Central America trade areas are modeled from our own vast free trade area, composed of 50 sovereign states. But while we seek a system of order in the world that will create and maintain peace, we are confronted with its cost, as well as the domestic cost of our economy. It is to this problem that I would like to address myself. Can we afford to be the force that maintains peace and still remain economically strong? In other words, can we afford both guns and butter? The answer is we cannot afford not to have both guns and butter. For the last 10 years, the national budget has included between 50 and 60 billions of dollars for the Defense Department. This is slightly more than half the cost of the government. In the past year, Vietnam has added an additional $13 billion of cost. That $13 billion amounts to less than 2% of all the goods and services that are created in the nation annually. For more than the past 10 years, the unemployment rate has been above 4% of those ready, willing, and able to work. In the last 2 years, determined efforts have been made to reach into the hardcore unemployed and create opportunities for them to share the common American experience. This was the chief reason for the past tax cut. It was the intention of the government to put money back into the hands of the consumer and permit the increased consumption to pick up the unemployed. Today, we have reduced unemployment to the lowest figure in 13 years. Only 3 7/10 of the people are unemployed. Due in a small way to Vietnam, but not solely, plus the domestic consumption, we are now experiencing labor shortages in skilled trades. Demand that pushes against the capacity to produce and shortages of some raw materials. The remedies that have been suggested are numerous. Some would suggest a tax increase, others a wage price stabilization board, and still others have suggested increased interest rates or restraint on credit. There are some who feel that the domestic programs should be curtailed. Whether it is because of Vietnam, the tax cuts in the past 2 years, the national expenditure program, or a combination of all these factors and some others. The most debated question in Washington today is the problem of inflation. Whether we should act now to stop increased inflation, and if so, what that action should be. A tax increase, drastic expenditure cuts, credit controls, or price and wage controls, or a combination of these solutions, or should we wait longer before any solution? If Vietnam were to be resolved within a matter of weeks, then the immediate need would be for a swift tax reduction and the assurance of increased federal expenditures. Beginning Wednesday of this week, a subcommittee which I chair will begin the consideration of the time to raise and lower taxes for the purpose of increasing prosperity or nipping inflation, and the method by which such increases or decreases can be accomplished. In my judgment, whether you have peace or continued problems in Vietnam, at least some can anticipate yet this year a tax decrease or increase. Other committees are constantly at work considering the expenditure program. The President has said that Vietnam, or for that matter, the defense establishment, will not be paid for by the poor. Defense should not be paid for by the young, and it cannot be paid for by the aged. In addition, the programs of land reclamation, soil conservation, and water and air purification are too essential to this and all succeeding generations to be cast aside. Even the moonshot cannot be downgraded. Russia is shooting for Mars. We must find without delay that method of slowing down the economy, which does the least permanent damage to the future. The investment credit tax should be suspended temporarily. Temporary income taxes must and will be considered. In my opinion, credit should be restrained. Think of it. 21 years from the bomb, and this nation worries about the cost of peace, of defense in both blood and money, and on the asset side, about the cost of prosperity. To the hardcore poor, to the unemployed, and to the low-income family. 101 years ago, when this university was dedicated, then President Williams of this university, in his dedicatory speech, said, "Our national government is now annually spending over $70 million. That sum is nearly all consumed in supporting destructive agencies. The Army costs more than $18 million and the Navy more than $12 million. They toil not, neither do they spin. The Patent Office is designed to foster and promote inventive genius, to abridge human labor, and to bring comfort to every door. Yet, while vast appropriations are made for other agencies, none are made for this. The only creative and positively producing function of the government is compelled to support itself. In 1855, therefore, the national defense budget ran about 40% of the total budget, and the national government had little concern about whatever other problems the nation may have had. Indeed, President Williams pointed out in his speech that the Senate had reorganized a few weeks before and discarded the Committee on Agriculture as of no importance. Approximately 80 to 90% of the people were then engaged in agriculture. But the years have changed America's knowledge, her concerns, and her power. It is as hard to believe now that on the eve of World War II, when America was, so to speak, still in adolescence, our defense expenditures were 12% of the national budget, as it is to believe that during the 50s, the defense rose to 58% of the budget. It is down now to 53%. 21 years after the bomb, we have grown in power, in knowledge, in wealth, and in responsibility. Regardless of what they say to their people, the government of every country in the world knows full well that we have no aggressive intention. We seek peace and an end to aggression everywhere. In a world where terror has become an instrument of government policy through large parts of the earth, this nation intends to be free. It intends to be safe. It intends to, and we are opening the gates of opportunity for all of its people, regardless of race, creed, sex, color, or religion. We intend to live in a better environment. We intend to, and we can, break the vicious grip of poverty. And what is more, this nation can pay the bill. Graduates of Michigan State University, you have come of age with the country. Welcome to adulthood and the tough but thrilling world of the 60s.
Mrs. Griffiths, thank you very much for that thoughtful and stimulating address. Everyone in this audience will agree that you have made this an outstanding occasion in the long history of this university.